Character Dude. Okay, woo, it's rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is Bobby Oliver, stand-up comedian, published author. You have a stand-up workshop that you do on a regular basis, right? Message about meditation. We want to talk about meditation a little bit?
Yes. Yeah.
All right, we can talk about that. We'll hear about all that in a moment, but first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Bobby Oliver. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. It's nice to see you.
I feel like it's been a while since I've seen you.
It feels like it's been a really long time. What's up? How's Chris, your husband?
Great. I meant to ask him to explain to me what a Death Star was.
Death Star?
Before I came. I think it's a Star Wars reference.
Come on. You really have no idea?
I mean, I kind of feel
really?
Like it's a ship.
It is, yes.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
a Star Wars thing.
Okay, yeah. I know. I just didn't know with enough confidence to just be sure.
I know you joke around that he's the nerdy
no,
one.
No, but I mean,
rock and roll one. But
I'm not into that. I mean, I've seen the movies, obviously,
yeah, okay.
but I don't collect anything or read anything or follow up on it in any way.
Yes.
Or remember the names of anyone or what anything is called.
Well, the Death Star was that planet-sized spaceship.
Oh, yeah. Darth Vader was on.
You know, was cruising around blowing planets up. And yeah.
So we're cruising around blowing comedy up? Comedians.
Well, this show is about the dark side of comedy.
There is definitely a dark side of comedy.
Yeah, that's what this show is about, the dark side of comedy.
Uh-huh.
I sent you that. You didn't.
I know, I read it this morning.
Okay.
I reread it this morning. I feel like there is definitely kind of an underbelly to comedy that only comedians know about.
An underbelly?
Yeah. I mean, not only comedians, anyone in the industry, you know, knows about, but I feel like the average person doesn't really know about it.
Well, what is that?
Well, I mean, I feel like when Robin Williams killed himself, I don't know a single comedian that was surprised.
Right.
But every real person I know was like, what? A comedian? What? He makes us all so happy. Well, yeah, he makes you happy.
Yeah, but that
doesn't mean he's happy.
So that surprises me a little bit that you think that the average citizen doesn't realize that most comedians struggle with
Well, I felt like when Robin Williams died, I was shocked at how many people didn't realize that. And I feel like, you know, the Bill Cosby raping 50-plus women. I feel like a lot of people are like, but he doesn't cuss in his act. But I feel like comedians know that there's a dark side to comedians. So we're not like, oh, my God, someone had a double life.
Yeah.
You know, we're like, yep, that... That makes sense. Double life, yeah.
Yeah.
I had a depression group for comedians.
Yeah, you did.
For a while. I actually stopped doing it because one of our members killed themselves.
Really?
Yeah. And
I was about to make a joke that you used to have a group for depressed comedians, but
Felt like, wow, I'm really doing everyone a lot of good if someone. But people have asked me recently to start it up again, so I may.
So, yeah, kind of a failure when you have a group for depressed comedians and somebody kills themselves.
Right. That's like the definition of a failure.
That's pretty much.
But we weren't like a therapy group. There was no therapist. There was no leader. We would just sit around and tell each other.
Be sad together.
How we feel. And the other one would be like, oh, my God, I think that very thing. I feel that very thing. And
that sounds depressing.
It actually helped me realize that I'm not the only one who hates myself as much, who hates me. I'm not the only one who hates me. But I'm not the only one who hates themselves that much or says those kinds of things to themselves.
Yeah.
And, I mean, as you know, comedians make a lot of suicide jokes.
Well, so why is that then? I mean, you know, we talk about this on the show. That there's obviously this connection, right, between things that are difficult and painful experiences and people that want to talk about it and make us laugh. And, you know, why do those things go together so
much? Well, I just think that the nature of comedy is that it takes a particularly damaged person to put themselves through that.
Through comedy.
Yes. Through what you have to endure in order to get good. and to stick with it. I mean, the comedy industry.
So I'm sorry. So healthy people would never do what it takes to go through what
watching the Game of Thrones on the couch with their dog and their loved one. And
so you have to be really a mess to go out there every night and get up on the stage and deal with hecklers and have nobody laugh. And
comedians are basically, I think, solitary people. I think we are a group of individuals who are mentally ill, have a lot of inward hate and outward, you know, projecting hate.
Yes.
And
they're related, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, oh, yes.
Not coincidental.
It's the same coin. Yeah. And we come together as a group, but we never cease to stay individuals. We never quite mailed into this homogenous organism.
Well, and even when we come together as a group, people are all socially awkward, and you know, it's not like it's a great group to be a part of.
Right, it's very competitive. First of all,
competitive.
Everyone's either or both, very low self-esteem or very narcissistic, which is the same thing, really. But we just. It's competitive, and, you know, if you go to a party of comedians, if you're a comedian, like you, a normal person, I think a regular person thinks that a party of comedians would be awesome and fun and hilarious, but you go to a party of comedians, and they're all just in the corner looking at their phone. Nobody is really interacting them. I'm not saying ever. I mean, obviously, we do have a good time together, and we have a family.
It's a bunch of addicts who are all socially awkward.
Yeah, but we're all socially awkward people who have a really hard time letting other people get to know us.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you go before a show, and all the comedians are in the green room looking at their phone, and no one's talking to each other.
Right.
So I think that underbelly, while maybe people in LA all have comedian friends and maybe know that they're the most depressed of all their friends, but I think just regular people were really shocked by the Robin Williams thing.
The Robin Williams thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had started the depression group for comedians like a month before Robin Williams killed himself. Everyone was like, oh, my God, that's so dumb. Why would you do that? That doesn't make any sense. And then Robin Williams killed himself, and everybody's like, you're a genius.
Did people really say
that? Yes.
Well,
they were like, why? Why? No comedians said that.
No comedians said that.
Right, all comedians were like, what day does it meet?
I saw you around that time, and I said, wow, what a great idea. And other people said, yes, I totally need that.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think regular people don't get that about us, you know?
Yeah. All right. I mean, yeah.
But at least we found a place we can be awkward.
On stage.
Well, I think that's where we're the least awkward. But I think at least when we're in the room with other comedians, we don't feel this pressure to pretend to not be awkward.
Well, that's how I came in, right? I mean, when we met, I had just gotten divorced for the third time, and... Yeah, I needed to process my stuff. You know,
I
needed to say this stuff out loud. Like, hey, this has happened to me, and the place to do it was with a microphone.
And I think you know you kind of inferred that earlier that most people they don't think, oh my God, I just went through this terrible thing. Let me write a joke about it. And I think that's part of our superpower. Yeah, let me go on stage. You know, I always tell two people, and I say in my book, you know, if you have this deep, dark fear that you think you would die if anybody ever knew about this particular thing, go on stage and tell 200 people about it.
See, that's exactly what it is. I'm not saying that I'm a smart person, but, you know, over time, you get to be 50, you start to realize, oh, I've been doing this all the time. This is not an accident. This is not me. This is me. This is what I do. When I find things like that freak me out, I go towards them. I'm just compelled to go towards them.
I mean, what else are you going to do? Because that's the only way to cope with it.
Denial is very useful, and a lot of people... No, I mean, that's why denial exists, because we can't deal with something, and so we shut it out.
Maybe comedians just aren't good at denial.
Maybe.
You know, I had a really severe stalker. A little over a year ago.
Okay.
I've had several stalkers. I've had several in-person stalkers. But this was a cyber stalker on Twitter. And this guy started like over 40 different Twitter accounts to write me and tell me he hoped I get raped, and he's going to show up at my show and rape me with a broken Coke bottle and slit my throat with it and call me a feminazi. I don't know if I can cuss.
Call me a feminazi. You already did. Yeah.
Did I?
I
don't think so. Call me a feminazi cunt like 40 times a day, which is now the name of my new CD.
Thank you.
Because it was it was so horrifying. I was sleeping with a hammer. I'm not kidding you. I went to the LAPD. They have search warrants served on Twitter. I went to the FBI. I was driving around with a hammer in my car, and I have a baseball bat. I went and bought mace and tried to buy a gun, but I couldn't afford it, and all this insane stuff. And so, it terrorized me for a good amount of time. Like, I lost a lot of sleep over this happening, and I wrote one of the best bits of my entire life about this dude.
Right.
And all I would do is the premise of every joke was something he said to me, like word for word. And I even ended up naming the CD Feminazi Cunt because he called me that so many times. I was like, okay, all right, I'll own it, you know? And I feel like that was a huge influence on that album. It was my third CD. I think it was a huge influence on that album and me. I mean, there's kind of a curse of happiness, you know, when you're a comedian, that if you're in a relationship that's going too well, or there, you know, I've been with the same guy for 27 years. Thank God he fucks up like every day. Or I would have no act. But there is kind of that curse of everything's going right in my life. What am I going to write about?
Yeah. No, I've had, you know, maybe Dylan Brody.
He's awesome.
Here. He's had a long struggle of being a depressed person. And so, you know, I asked him about this kind of cliche. All kinds of artists that they, you know, if they lose their darkness, that they can't write or they can't paint. And he said, oh, God. You know, he said, no, you know, that's a lie that you still got to go and you shouldn't have to live that way.
But I think there is enough.
Everything is good. It's not easy. It's not easy.
You know, people are like, oh, Trump is going to be a gift to comedians. You know what? You can have that gift. You can keep that gift. I'll find something else to write about. But, you know, if you're not writing about tumultuous things that are happening in your life, you can write about political things. I like to talk about politics a lot. Yeah. And so there's always some sort of conflict that you can base.
Always,
you know,
something that pisses you off.
There's always. Maybe comedians are just easily pissed off.
Well, I do think there's a certain thing about that, right? I mean, it's obviously people that have issues with stuff.
Well, and I've always thought that we observed things more than most people, too. Right. Like, we're not the participants. Like, we're not the captain of the football team. We're not playing. We're standing in the corner making fun of that.
Right.
So I think it made us good observers.
Yeah.
To notice those kinds of things. Yeah, I think comedians are that perfect balance between low self-esteem and cocky shithead. If you have too much of one or the other, you're going to end up either never performing or just being an actor. You know, like you're never going to.
Yeah.
We need that dose of self-hatred.
And then, you know, that's where family comes in. Your family's like the thing that primes the pump, you know what I mean? It gets it started.
I mean, I don't think every comedian necessarily had a bad childhood, but I think a lot of the comedians had. Maybe their circumstances might not have been bad, but maybe they had some sort of anxiety disorder or something that caused them to react to life in a way that maybe a well-adjusted person wouldn't.
Well, I think even so-called well-adjusted people, I mean, everybody has weird stuff that happens to them in their family, in their childhood. You know, your parents are not perfect, whatever. I think a lot of people.
And you either end up developing a fetish, like jerk off into shoes, or you write jokes.
Or both.
Go on stage and let strangers stare at you with indifference.
Tell a lot of jokes about your family.
I used to.
You used to.
I used to. I think the good thing about making CDs and putting them out there is it gives you permission to stop talking about that and to start working toward the next thing.
Yeah.
I still have jokes about my husband.
Well, yeah.
Because he's a constant.
Yeah, he's
around. Know?
Yeah.
But I haven't been with, you know, my immediate family for a long time, thank God.
That's why you're here.
But I think part of getting older as a comedian and being in the business for so long, I've kind of, you know, moved out of just talking about personal things, and I've dealt with so many things already on stage that it allows me to look outward toward political and cultural things. And I mean, so there's always something to complain about.
So tell people, tell us about your book, right? I've read your book and stuff, but tell us, what is the Tao of Comedy?
Yes,
right?
It's called the Tao of Comedy, yep. Embrace the Pause, mm-hmm. And it's about using specific Zen Buddhist and Taoist components to their philosophy toward being an artist, applying it to seeking a spiritual path through art.
Yeah, not just comedy. I mean, right. You can apply it to all kinds of
things. A lot of people have read it who aren't comedians and told me it helped them with their band or whatever, you know, fine arts. I've spoken at Cal Arts, and they're like a fine arts college and stuff. I've spoken at UCLA the other day, but that was about women in comedy. But
so then what's the angle? Because, I mean, I understand what that is. And so, how does that apply to
it? Well, the angle is that comedy has somehow become a marketing scheme.
Okay.
It's a stepping stone to something better, you know, in quotes. Like
fame and fortune.
Yeah, people are like, oh, well, let me do comedy so I can get rich and famous and have a car collection like Jay Leno and, you know, all this. But like, that happens to, like, 10 people on Earth.
Fewer.
There's one Jay Leno, you know what I mean? Yeah. So four people have taken over this night show in the history of the world. So, That becomes the goal. If that becomes the goal, that becomes the focus, then it's infecting everything else you're doing. How you're writing, how you're approaching persona, material, stage presence, everything. And so it is encouraging you to become this one-dimensional caricature of yourself and to talk about things that are marketable and will sell in Cleveland.
Right.
And you end up with this very false shell, this kind of hack, you know, hack persona, hack act. So the point of the book is to forget all about that. What comes of it, the purpose of comedy is not to become rich and famous. The purpose of comedy is to do comedy. And if you fall in love with the process, you know, what if I tried this word? What if I moved it here? What if I did this number of syllables? Then if you're in love with, and you define success as working the craft and putting out the best, most authentic material that you can, then you are successful. And then because that's your goal and not to be marketable, you're not just being a one-dimensional caricature. You're talking about all things in your life, and you don't care if they conflict each other because life naturally conflicts. And you explore all sides of yourself, and you allow yourself to be real and authentic, and you write about the things you care about. And then that makes you just a much better comic and a more fulfilled comic and just a more original and prolific writer, the more you can tap into your own authenticity.
Your realness. You become more real.
Right. Your true self underneath it all.
And then what's about the pause? Because the pause is really very literal for you. It's a space. It's an opening.
Right. It has several meanings for me. I have the word pause tattooed on my wrist. And by the way, the reason why I put it right here is because this is where I try to kill myself.
Uh-huh.
So it means several things to me, you know, stop. But I refer to the pause on one level on stage. Comedy comes from nothingness. Hmm. Comedy is in the silence. It's in the pauses. The Smothers Brothers will tell you that. Jack Benny will tell you that. Carol Burnett will tell you that. Everybody will tell you comedy is in the silence. But also, it's about inserting space into your life. So meditating, practicing mindfulness, not multitasking, you know, not continuing to split yourself from the moment, but being as present in the moment and in your life as possible. Because the secret to life is, if you want something, first pursue nothing. Because nothingness is where something has a space to move into. And everyone wants that big aha moment, that big idea, but their head is just full all the time of thinking and thoughts and da-da. There's no space for that aha moment to move into.
So I'm glad you mentioned that last part, because I was going to say, can we just break that down into a literal? Because people say that, like, oh, you need to have the pause and pursue nothing. And it sounds all good and Buddhist. And then you say, well, what does that mean? How do I do that?
It's the path to the connection to yourself.
Yes.
Is in the pause. I mean, I always say that the world is shouting at you. you know, your job, your family, your texts, your emails, your work, Facebook, the whole, you know, traffic, the whole world is shouting at you.
Yes.
But your true self is whispering to you.
Yeah.
And you can't hear it because of all the chatter.
Right.
And all the noise. And the main thing, pausing and being in the moment and focusing on your breath or paying attention, just plain paying attention to what you're doing instead of thinking your way through it, it opens up this path to the creative source, to your authentic self, to creativity. And so instead of sitting in a room going, oh, what's funny?
Right.
You tap into this true self, this creativity, the Tao, the force. Right. And you just see funny things everywhere.
Well, I agree with you 100%. You know, the way I would put this is just in terms of our environment around us. Yeah, it has become louder and busier and more fragmented than at any other time in human history.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the messages that you're talking about, right, about the our creativity, our ideas, right? What do I want to talk about? What do I want to think? What am I curious about?
Mm-hmm.
Those are subtle.
Right.
They're subtle signals. And you have to focus on them and make space for them, or you're just not going to hear them. So what I'm trying to get at is this is a very practical approach.
I mean, it literally makes you a better comedian.
There are times when people think this stuff all sounds very like hippy-dippy or something, and yeah, but how do I do it? It's really mm-hmm. practical because mm-hmm. we're trying to tune in to subtle signals because these other things are so loud and constantly bombarding us. And if we allow ourselves, they pull us in multiple different directions all day long. And, you know, things are shouting, hey, look at me.
Mm-hmm.
And
we're not really having experiences.
No, we completely give up control and you're only reacting mm-hmm. in that part of it.
And also, I've read some stuff that says that we are also breathing more shallow.
Mm-hmm.
And that in the West, we breathe more shallow than in the East. They
yes.
breathe deeper than us.
Yep.
So we're basically just creating this ball of anxiety for ourselves all the
yeah.
time by not breathing deeply enough, by not being in the moment. I mean, I've been in yoga class before and noticed, I realized the whole time I was in yoga, I was thinking about my bills.
Yeah.
And stuff I had to pay. I'm like, what am I even doing here?
And you may not realize that's happening until it's over.
Right.
And then you literally
or
say,
or you've missed
oh,
the whole movie and you're like, what just happened? See, Buddha means he who woke up.
Right.
So basically, we don't even realize that we're in this, we're asleep.
Yes.
We're going through life.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times has your car just driven to where you normally go and you're like, wow, I don't even remember driving here. Or you're supposed to be going somewhere else, but you drive to work. You know, we're just all
yeah.
just
it
asleep.
It happens weekly that I realize I don't remember getting here.
Right. I mean, people are even doing things like leaving their babies in their car and going into work and the baby dying because they're just sleepwalking through their life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, once you become aware that you are not your thoughts, you are the thing that is aware of your thoughts, then it starts becoming easier to recognize if you're actually experiencing something or just thinking your way through it. And it becomes easier, like with a focal point like breath or something else,
right.
to turn that voice off.
Right. And you want to have the choice, right? Because what we don't have most of the time is the choice to turn it off sometimes.
And we don't even know there is a choice.
That's the thing, right? If you meditate, even if you meditate every day, it's 15 or 20 minutes out of 24 hours
mm-hmm.
that you're choosing to put your attention someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Even that little bit is super helpful.
I even think 5 minutes a day before you leave
yeah.
is helpful.
Yeah.
It's like the voice is something that we're supposed to be able to utilize when we need to think and do math. And then we're supposed to turn it off when we're not using it. But we don't know. It's like a radio. The knob's been ripped off. Like, we don't know how to turn it off.
It
so we're just going through life narrating, you know, tree, rock, that woman I hate across the street. Like, I walked into a bathroom once and the voice said, it's cold in here. And I was like, I don't need the voice to tell me it's cold in here.
Yeah.
I have skin to tell me it's cold in here.
Yeah.
You know, we're narrating our way through life and we're going, oh, that's a tree. And then we're just filling in what we know about every other tree. We didn't really stop and look at that tree and experience that tree. And we don't even know we're doing that.
Yeah. That's the key. We don't realize that we're doing it.
We think that we are the voice. I mean, it uses words like me and I.
Yeah, that's the problem.
We think we must believe these things. It's saying, well, I must feel this. The voice is saying it. But my friend David Rosowski says, the voice in your head is a liar and an asshole.
So let me ask you a question about that. You obviously are kind of in touch with that voice for you, right? Because we can't make it go away. But if you...
You can take breaks from it.
You can take breaks. And if you actually pay attention to it more, then you get to recognize it for what it is. A lot of times we run away from it because it says shitty things to us, and we keep hiding.
But you can observe it and watch it without engaging in it.
Yes.
Like you can watch a fire truck go by, and then when the fire truck goes by, you can go on about your life. Yeah. Or while the fire truck's going by, you can be like, oh my God, I wonder who's hurt. I wonder if somebody down the street. Oh, my friend lives down there. Oh, you know, just you could tell this whole story about the fire truck.
Right.
Or you could just let the fire truck be a moment in time.
So when you think about that voice, I have a question just about, do you or have you given that voice kind of its own physical presence? Like, does it have a body? Is it a creature for you?
I mean,
what color is your gremlin? Is basically my question.
You know, that's a great tool actually to go through and like describe pains that you're feeling, name the color of them, and the way. I call my voice Jean because that's my mama's name.
Okay,
and I feel like I kind of took over abusing me where she left off.
Okay, and you know? So Jean for you, what kind of physical characteristics? Yeah, she resembled your mother? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I don't really think of it in terms of what it looks like. I just think of it in terms of the feeling that it gives me when it starts in on me. And it is very much that feeling that you're the helpless child and you're being told you're not good enough, you're not whatever enough, and nobody likes you. And my trigger is rejection. Mm-hmm. I think people are rejecting me all the time. So I have to be really careful to stand back and go, you're spinning this.
Right.
You know, they say that, you know, you don't see the world as it is. You see the world as you are.
Correct.
So whatever narrative you tell yourself, you can find plenty of evidence in your world to support that narrative.
Well, and you can train people in your life to be that, right?
Right,
you think,
right.
Oh, why am I keep marrying the same asshole? You don't keep marrying the same asshole, but you may find people and you train them to be the person.
You're either attracting them or you're teaching them how to treat you.
Yeah. So, I mean, all that all happens unconsciously.
And sometimes the person is only an asshole in your presence. It's something about the way the two of you click.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, there's a guy that has a book about this, and it is called Taming Your Gremlin. And as a psychologist, this is his work, is to help people tune into that voice that talks to them all the time, really listen to what it says, go through some visualization to create or discover physically what kind of creature this is, and to be in relationship with that thing.
Right.
And as a life coach, I've used it with my clients.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had one client that we identified this voice and, you know, that was useful. But then he said there are some other voices in there. And by the end of our work, we had created a kind of board of directors where he was... My client is the chairman, and then there are like these seven other voices. Some of them are positive, some of them are negative.
Like that new movie, that new cartoon about feelings, where there's all these different kind of...
But he recognized that there are these multiple voices in his head that have things to say, and even when they make us feel shitty, there's always some wisdom. I try to say, look, there's something... this thing is trying to protect you or it's trying to save you from something, and maybe it's going about it all the wrong way.
Right,
makes
you
feel really bad. But, you know, it's afraid. And whatever it's afraid of, it's a kind of compensatory
system.
Kind
of like a parent who does that to you.
Yeah.
They really just, you know, think they're trying to protect you.
Yeah.
There's a great book called Women, Food, and God. And it talks about this. And just like my book is about meditation and mindfulness, but it happens to be about comedy.
Yes.
Women, Food, and God is about mindfulness, but it happens to be about eating disorders.
Okay.
But it's the best book about mindfulness I've ever read in my life. And it talks about when you're feeling this feeling, to identify where do you feel it in your body.
Yes.
Is it in your chest? Is it in your stomach? Is it a heavy feeling? Is it an empty feeling? What color does it have?
Yeah.
So instead of being like, oh my God, this thing happened and then this is going to happen and then my whole life, instead of building a story around it, asking yourself, what is the actual physical sensation that I'm feeling? And yeah, this sucks or whatever, but I can actually deal with, I just kind of feel this emptiness in my chest that's kind of hard and gray right now. And then when you start looking at it just like that, it loses its power because you're not telling this whole story about it. In fact, I just heard on NPR that there's been studies done that prove that you feel pain differently after a gunshot wound depending on the circumstances in which you were shot. So if you were shot...
So, other kinds of pain.
Well, no. The pain of the bullet.
The pain of the bullet.
So the pain of the wound. So if you are a soldier and you get shot and you know that you're going to be, now you're going to be taken off to a hospital, they're going to take care of you, then you get to go home and see your family, and now you're out. You don't need as much opium. Not opium. What do they call it?
Whatever. Painkillers.
Whatever it is in the hospital version of
it. I think they use something else.
Morphine. That's what it is. But if you were like own a liquor store and it's supporting your family and you get shot and you're like, oh, I don't have any insurance and I don't know what's going to happen to my family because I can't run the store while I'm down, you need more pain pills because you are feeling that experience a lot differently and more tragically.
Wow. That's an interesting research. Somebody's a little twisted to be asking that question.
But I mean, well, they did is they studied, people are... request their own or press the button for their own. And they're studying the different circumstances in which how much painkiller is needed.
It's a very hard measure. It's not kind of like a rating scale. It's a very hard measure of how many times they press the button
to
say, I need more medication.
And that it depends on the circumstances.
Well, I've worked out something, a meditative form for myself that, you know, I have kind of tried to tell jokes about, which maybe doesn't work or maybe it works. But... I think it's funny, but it actually works. I call it hair trigger meditation. You know, because in a lot of meditative forms, they say, you know, you have to begin by clearing your mind. Well, I can't clear my mind. You know, I hate my ex-wife so much, I can't clear it. And that's where it came from. I don't really hate her, but it came from, having an ex-wife that was driving me crazy. And so the method is not to try to get away from that. The method is... think about that thing that is your hair trigger that can instantly set you off.
Right.
And if you go right at that thing and let it upset you, and when you're there, just now really observe, what does that do to your body?
Right.
Like you're saying. Forget the story. Let the story run rampant. Let it go. Even fuel it. Mm-hmm. Forget about that. It's going to happen. What does it do to your body? And while I am having this kind of anxiety attack in my mind, if I can still separate and relax and breathe through the physical part of that, now it starts to pry those two things apart a little bit.
Right.
And it changes it. It really changes it. Because now when things happen, I recognize that that physical sensation is beginning and not just wrapped up in it. So, it is kind of a joke to call it the hair trigger meditation, but
it's a great idea. And what we're doing with this story that we're telling ourselves, the ex-wife or whatever, we're putting ourselves in fight or flight.
Yes.
And our body is going through as if we're being chased by a tiger.
That's exactly right.
You know, and so you know.
So that's what this does. Yes. It puts me mentally in that thing, and then I physically can, just observing it and saying, wow, can I let that go without, I don't have to let go of the story. I don't have to let go of the thing that she did or what I said, she said. I can have all that. I just have to manage my physicality at the same time.
Right. And you are the thing that is going, that is observing, oh, this is what my mind does when I start thinking about this. Oh, this is how the body reacts when the mind thinks like this. So you're no longer the story. You're no longer lost in thought. You're the thing that is aware that you think. Well, and also it's about the present moment. You know, mindfulness is about being in the now. And so if you were anxious or upset about that, check in with your head. Are you in the present? No. I'm thinking about this person that pissed me off before. I'm thinking about, oh my God, what's going to happen on Friday when I go up to the thing, you know? And if you're in the past or you're in the present, you're trying to pre-cope. Right. You're trying to predict and pre-cope. You're trying to cross a bridge before you come to it.
Control.
Or you're trying to solve a problem that already happened, and you can't redo the thing you want. And so that's putting you in this state of anxiety, too. And so bringing yourself into the moment by finding something to focus on, like your breath is a great thing, because it's free and you always have it on you.
Well, but it's also happening right here, right now.
And you can observe how you're breathing and then work on slowing the breath down and making yourself breathe more deeply and being in that moment. And it's just a little break from it.
Yeah.
Because the mind is always coming back.
See, I notice for myself that when I get wrapped up in this place, it is because I'm struggling with somebody or some issue.
Mm-hmm.
And in my head, I'm planning out, I'm going to say this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to say that. And then this is how I'm going to get it. Here's how I'm going to get what I want by saying.
But in real life, have they ever gone along with the script?
No, it never does. but even in my imagination, you know, like I'm winning the thing, and I just feel everything clenching up.
Mm-hmm. It's like hecklers. Yeah. I always say, deal with the heckler in front of you, not with this fear you have about being heckled. And what am I going to do the day I get heckled? And trying to plan what you're going to say, because they never heckle you in the way in your mind you thought it was going to go down. So you can't just say the thing, you know.
Right.
So rather than being like, oh my God, this huge thing, deal with the person in front of you. Are they being mean? Are they just being kind of loud? Like, don't build this whole, oh my God, heckler story. Just be present with it and deal with the situation in front of you.
Well, and just to bring it full circle, there's your moment of pause, right? Because when you're on stage, if you have the moment, if you can deal with yourself enough to have that moment of pause and let there be a moment of silence and to take a breath, the things show up. Something happens for you, right? And whenever we try to push it and rush it and squeeze it in,
we're pushing it away.
Then we, you know, we're not connected.
And if you can't sit on your bed for 5 minutes alone and be quiet in the pause, how can you pause on stage with 200 people staring at you?
Yeah. It's difficult. Well, I just got to tell you the ultimate level of that meditation technique is the highest level I call is the gaping asshole meditation, where, you know, if you can relax your pelvic floor enough that you can actually feel air go into your asshole a little bit, that means you're really relaxed. That's the true test.
That's the litmus
true test. Yes, if you can actually feel a little air go in, you know that you've reached the point.
That is some serious self-awareness.
That's
right
really
there.
Self-aware. All right, let me change. Can we change the subject completely? Across the street there at your studio, you have a little Dow studio. You were running for a while an all-girl open mic night.
Yes.
Are you still doing that?
Yes, women only every Monday night. We have three open mics a week.
Yeah.
Wednesdays and Fridays are co-ed, and Monday nights women only.
Mm-hmm.
And I may be starting like a Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock women only mic too.
Okay. Tell me, what about the women only thing? Why is that important to do in the Los Angeles comedy scene right now?
It's so therapeutic and cathartic, and I feel like they're so, first of all, just in sheer numbers, we don't get to see, female comics don't get to see each other as often because there's a lineup, there's 20 dudes and one girl, one woman. So we're like, you know, or we go to the open mic, it's not uncommon to be the only woman or only a couple of women. And so we don't actually get to see each other work together that often. But also there's, you know, open comedy in general, but open mics specifically can be very unwelcoming places for women. Sometimes overtly on purpose. Sometimes it's so just ingrained. No, people don't even notice. The guys don't even notice they're doing it.
Well, it can be unfriendly for anybody.
Yes, unfriendly for anybody.
Not deliberately, just like we said, awkward and all the reasons.
But
for women especially.
If comedy were, you know, 75% female.
Yeah.
And women were going on stage telling castration jokes one after the other and were very hostile toward. I don't think as many men would do comedy as women do comedy now.
Like, so some of it is content, what the guys talk about. That creates
the rape jokes, violence against women jokes, just harassing and hitting on women from the stage, outside the stage. Hey, let me help you with your act. Let me tell you that. It's like, dude, you've only been doing comedy a year. Fuck off. You know, or what, you know, it's just, and because we've been set up, first of all, just our society in general, but in comedy specifically, women have been set up to see each other as competition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, if there's even 20 dudes, and even more than men do. If there's 20 guys in a show and a woman got a spot, that means I didn't get the spot.
Right.
I'm not. Why am I not mad at the 19 dudes, you know, or 20 dudes, you know? So we tend to see each other as competition in physically and artistically. And so the reason why I don't allow any men to even be in the room during our women-only mics is because I used to have women-only mics where men could come and watch. And I discovered that if there's one man in the room, all the women act differently.
That was my other question, right? Because I'm not there. So,
right.
And I want to know, how is it different?
They act differently toward each other.
Yeah.
They all of a sudden, this adversarial relationship comes back toward each other, and we're not as vulnerable or talk about the kinds of things. And so what I think the women's mic does is not only do we get to now form these great friendships that we can go, you know, like I said, we had 40 women at the open mic last week. We can go to other mics together and be like, hey, I this place is near me, but it's kind of rapey. Could you meet me there? You know, we can support each other, form friendships, start our own shows, put each other in them, but also just if material is at its rawest, newest, most vulnerable place, it never is going to get to that good, solid, funny place if you don't have a place you can feel comfortable working that material.
Yeah.
And so if stuff is really vulnerable, a woman might not be comfortable being the only woman in the mic discussing that material, you know, like maybe about having been raped or something like that. Might not feel comfortable discussing that in a room full of men, whereas would feel more comfortable there and then get it, work it to the place where they're ready to take it out to the rest of the world, and they become bulletproof after that.
Yeah.
But it really is just a safe space.
So you get different kinds of material that women are willing to say and work on when there are no men even in the audience.
And I think it's more authentic.
And it feels different. It just feels different in the environment of being.
Yeah, and most of women, I mean, we're all different kinds of women. So some of us wear makeup and dress up. Some of us wear sweatpants and T-shirts, you know, but I feel like
you're still just normal people.
I know. Yeah. It's funny. It's like almost like we're people.
Yeah, almost.
But we just really have just kind of formed this bond. And everything I've ever done, I started as a reaction to something else. Like the comedy workshops and the book I wrote were a reaction to the way I saw comedy being this horrible marketing scheme.
Yes.
The women's open mic, I started as a reaction to being tired of being the only chick at the open mic and just the hostility of, and like we call our Wednesday and Friday mic rape-free mics because we have the no pro rape joke policy. Like you can talk about rape, but you can't talk pro rape.
Okay.
Like, fuck that bitch. She had it coming. She's a money grubbing whore or whatever.
Yeah.
But
that's kind of new because I've been some mics over at your place where you were struggling to.
Had to make a rule because
to get the policy.
It was just.
Yeah.
We tried everything.
Yeah.
I tried going on stage and making fun of the dudes afterward and being funnier than they were in the making fun of them.
Right, right.
You know, being like, do you just go home to your dead mother in a rocking chair at night? Being like, my rape jokes were the best tonight, mother. I tried talking to them and telling them
afterwards.
I've been raped. I have rape PTSD. This room, my one room studio, Dow Comedy Studio, costs more than my 3-bedroom house. And I don't bust my ass to pay rent there every month. I mean, to come there and feel traumatized every week, you know?
Right.
I tried everything. And then, actually, it was Chris's decision I was even horrified to make that decision because but I'm the one that gets all the shit for it. He doesn't.
Yeah.
But that was a reaction. I have a show once a month called Pussy Riot. Which is a feminist comedy show. We have a show every Saturday night that's, you know, regular show. But I did that just so I could encourage more, like, hardcore, in-your-face feminist voices. But we always have a man in it every time.
Mm-hmm.
And my festival, the Laugh Riot Girl Festival, it was, I got tired of watching festivals that have, like, no women or 5 women. Or there are festivals that have, like, 5 women.
Right.
Or there are flyers come out with festivals. There's not one female name or picture on the whole festival. Like,
And it's a 3-day festival that's like hours a day.
It's like a week long and that you couldn't find any, you know? And I also was in festivals where I knew that unbelievably funny women I know had submitted to that festival and didn't get in, but then the hackest dude talking about jerking off in a sock is up, you know what I mean? And so I got tired of that. I even tried to talk to some of these places personally without calling them out and saying, hey, I think you should, you know, try to get more women in here. And I was in this one festival where they had meet and greets for the comedians and the bookers. One of them was at a strip club. I'm supposed to go try to get this booker to take me seriously as an artist while some girl has her cooch in his face, you know?
Probably not going to happen.
Probably not. And some guys don't want to be in that situation either, you know?
No, I don't want to be in that situation. No, I'm one of those guys. One time I went to a strip club, and it was like a bachelor party thing, and I just did not want to be there.
It's
not a sexy place for me. You have to have this willing
suspension
of disbelief.
And it's certainly not a working environment.
No.
You know, so I started that festival to be like, hey, let's have a women focused festival that's all women headliners. And we'd have like 20 dudes in it.
Yeah.
There was like 30 guys in it last year, but we had to split it because it was too big a festival. But I made it a little smaller. It's 100 comics.
Okay.
And it's called Laugh Riot Girl because I was inspired by the Riot Girl punk rock feminist movement in the 90s.
Yes.
And Pussy Riot, the Russian activists, were inspired by Riot Girl.
Got it. Those are New Yorkers, right? The Riot Girl people? Weren't they in New York?
Yeah, Kathleen Hanna and, Carrie Brownstein from Portlandia has a band called Slater Kinney. They were part of the Riot Girl movement. Man. Yeah, but Bikini Kill and Huggy Bear and all these bands.
Yeah.
Kurt Cobain and Dave Grohl were Riot Girl supporters.
Yeah. So just give some details. Laugh Riot Girl Festival, the dates of that?
It's June 6th through 13th, but the 6th is the women-only event, which is a women in comedy roundtable followed by an open mic. The 7th through the 12th are nightly, and some nights multiple shows a night of stand-ups and storytellers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the last night is the rap party, the 13th.
Okay.
Is the rap party / open mic.
And everything happens at your studio?
Yes, and it's $5 to attend any show, no drink minimums.
Okay.
It's super fun, super funny.
And tell people the address, because that's useful.
Dow Comedy Studio is at 7466.
It's on the card,
Beverly Boulevard, Suite 201, so we're upstairs. Los Angeles, 90036.
I love that you're reading the thing.
I'm scared I was going to say it wrong on the radio because I never have to recite it. But we're on Beverly Boulevard between La Brea and Fairfax.
Yeah, it's a nice little space.
It is.
No,
yes,
you've really made it.
Right.
You've made it very warm.
It's very zen,
and comfortable. It does not feel like a typical kind of comedy open mic.
Yes, place, it's all like black suede sofas and incense burning. And
yes,
just really supportive and comfortable. My goal was for every seat to be comfortable.
Yeah. Well, then you got it. All right, let's change the subject, because that was good. It was serious, pretty good, a lot of serious stuff. I'm going to do this. You know, one of the things I like to do just to see what happens is to anagram stuff, right? Take the letters of somebody's name, and if you rearrange them, does it spell any other kinds of things?
Yeah.
So I was trying to do it for you. So I anagrammed Dow of Comedy, and then also The Dow of Comedy, which is literally the title of your book, and then your name. And there are a lot of things.
I feel like Boob Be Viral does a pretty good, or Viral.
Boob Be Viral.
Yeah. I feel like that's
an anagram of Bobby Oliver. Yeah.
That's pretty on point.
That's on point.
So. Do My Face Too. I could see that relating to my life. Cat-footed homie. All right, that's my new nickname.
See?
I demand to be called Cat-footed homie for the rest of my life.
See, now.
Faceted homo toy? Okay, that's just, now I'm trying to imagine it. Decaf moo toy? That sounds like something that you get at the bottom of coffee.
Yeah, when you have a coffee, you always have a coffee thing.
Right?
Yeah. Decaf moo toy, yes. Food coma yet? I liked this one also. Cat moody foe.
That does describe cats
cat,
very well.
Cat: moody foe, yeah.
But decay of moot. I mean, that sounds like the name of my next book.
That sounds like a punk band to me, Decay of Moot.
I want to have a women's punk band called Lashes. I can't play any instruments, but that's never stopped anyone from forming a punk band before.
Sid Vicious or, you know, Sid was a classic. But, Cat-Footed Homie. Yeah, but Boob Be Virile. Yeah, I thought that was
you. Yeah, that's me in a nutshell.
Yeah. But also maybe this one, Ebb, I Boil Over.
I do boil over a lot.
Yeah, so, you know. Yeah, Dylan Brody, again, just to bring him up, his name, he says he's a word guy, right? And he said, I anagram things all the time.
He's in our festival.
Yeah, he's
in the storytelling show.
Yeah, he's
in the storytelling show.
His name anagrams to ran by oddly. And he was astounded that he had never thought of that. Uh-huh. And he says he does have a weird kind of run. And so...
Oh, he does run weird. He does run by oddly.
Dylan Brody ran by oddly.
I want to see him run now.
That's how it goes.
I probably run oddly, too, but no one knows because I don't run.
Because you don't run. Here's a question. You have a somewhat quirky sleeping ritual or bedtime ritual. What is it?
I don't know what you're referring to. I know what my bedtime ritual is.
Yeah, what is
something? It's like lots of weed and a Benadryl and meditation. Why? What do you mean?
You did the meditation before the weed and the Benadryl or after?
I mean, the weed is a constant, so before, during, after.
You don't have any, I don't know. This is a totally fishing question. Some people say no.
Oh, so you aren't referring to anything specific.
Well, not as far as I know, but...
Yeah. I don't...
You'd be surprised how many people say, oh my God, it's
how
this.
How did you know, right?
And then they reveal
Are you watching
something.
Me? Yeah. Well, pot is the reason, is just the reason why I'm not in jail or dead. And so if I don't smoke, I will be up for like weeks.
You'll be awake?
Yes, really? Yes. Okay. My child is on sleeping medication. Well, I raised my sister's two kids. Yeah. She's like 27 now. Yeah. But she has to take something similar to Benadryl every night. It's like Benadryl without the allergy stuff. But we're not sleepers.
Yeah, what would happen if you just...
I mean, when I've tried to quit smoking pot before, I've gone like weeks, like I'm have a psychotic episode. Like I'm bad. My mama was the same way.
So your body doesn't want to sleep, but it does fuck with your head.
Right.
And so,
it messes with you to not sleep.
Totally.
You know, I just heard that Prince was awake for like 5 days before he died.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if that's just something somebody said on the internet or if that's a true fact.
Well, now these little things are leaking, like he was awake for 5 days or he had pain medication.
Well, and Michael Jackson couldn't sleep.
Jackson,
I mean, maybe it's if your brain is just too active or too creative. I don't know, but I do tend to go to bed about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I do get up about 11. Well, I mean, I usually wake up before that, like 9 or 10, but I stay in bed.
Yeah, but that's actual sleep. You get like a good 5 or 6
hours. Yeah, oh yeah,
I
do get sleep, but if I didn't smoke enough pot to put down a horse.
Okay, all right. So no quirky sleeping rituals necessarily.
Just cushion Benadryl.
Here's something else. As a child, you had an imaginary friend.
No.
Okay.
I was obsessed and still kind of am with stuffed animals.
Well,
that stuffed animals have a soul. Anyway, what?
My question was this, and maybe it'll be appropriate for your stuffed animals. I was going to say, as a child, you had an imaginary friend. Your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now? But you can answer this about stuffed animals.
Well, I did not allow my stuffed animals to have any other friends than me. But my sister, I have always had a Snoopy. Like, that was a Snoopy dog. Snoopy was kind of the witness to my childhood for me. And my sister took my Snoopy to school and lost him. And it pretty much devastated my whole life. My mama made her take it for Halloween. She was dressed up as like a kid or whatever, and she lost my Snoopy. And it had a huge devastating effect on me for a large part of my life. And then as an adult, my parents gave me another Snoopy, and a good comedy friend of mine, Hannah Michaels, gave me a Snoopy, and it looks just like the Snoopy I had when I was a kid. And when she first gave it to me and I took it out of the box, I had like a triggered panic attack from it looking so much like, but I don't know where Snoopy is now that my sister lost.
Whatever years later.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I mean,
and that's the Snoopy my parents gave me, I didn't have that because it was dressed like Santa Claus. It didn't look like me. I was like, a Snoopy. I was like, a little too late. But when my friend gave me that, it looked so much like my childhood Snoopy that I went into this, because I had a very abusive childhood, and I felt like Snoopy was kind of with me through that.
Yeah, no, I get it.
And I felt like he'd come back. And one time I was tripping on mushrooms a couple years ago, and I saw Snoopy. And I broke down into like a serious, like weeping, from my childhood.
In that trippy experience, did he have something to say to you?
Snoopy, being in the, and I actually took the mushrooms to have a cathartic experience because I felt like I needed to work some shit out.
Yeah, that's the way.
And in my experience, every time I do mushrooms, I come out of it a different person.
Yeah, that's.
And so I hadn't done them in like 25 years. So I did them. And, but when I saw Snoopy, I started remembering all these. Like, I don't remember most of my childhood. I've repressed it, but it started.
For good reason. Yeah,
The mind is kind. Yeah. So I started remembering lots of stuff. And I remember saying, Snoopy believes me and stuff like that. And I was really.
So in your trip, he was kind of like a guide.
Yeah, Snoopy was my tripping guide. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was awesome. No, I feel like I shouldn't recommend drugs, but. I don't not recommend them either. Don't discourage.
No, I'm not a super big recreational drug user, but I have used things like that because I was at certain moments in my life, or I needed to go into a place that was not completely accessible, and I wanted to go there. And
it's so like going up to the mountain and getting your head together.
Yeah, I've used hallucinogenics for that. And it's been great. And even, you know, I'm like, okay, I've been here before. Yes, here's the message for me again. You know, you get presented with a choice in that state about how you want to be in the world and what you can do with your life. And, it can be really super therapeutic.
Yeah, and I felt like in that moment, like that Snoopy became my old Snoopy. Like the soul of my Snoopy, I felt like I recognized it in the new Snoopy.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense to me. Wow. No, I got a hit because it's like Linus, if you took away his blanket.
Yeah,
your mom made you.
Because we weren't allowed to have pets or anything growing. Like, we were just in this seven people in a tiny little trailer.
Right.
Just, I felt like it was like an experiment to see how small a place you could put that many people in before someone shot someone, which they did twice.
No, that's a, wow, oof. Yeah, your mom made you give
Let
it to
my
your sister,
sister yeah.
And then she took it, and it was gone.
Yeah, and I had an even more severe kind of breakdown after that, and ended up having to see a psychiatrist. I started seeing a psychiatrist
when
I was like
that happened?
Fourth grade. Well,
so
I started seeing a psychiatrist in fourth grade.
But yeah, that's how old my kid is right now. He's 11 years old. He's in fourth grade. He just turned 11, so that's when that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah, heavy. I saw a therapist from the time that's weekly. Heavy. From fourth grade until I was a sophomore in college, and I was in two different mental hospitals. Well, I spent all of 11th grade in a mental hospital.
Other people in your family had that same experience as you did?
Okay. Me, my brother, my mama, my grandmama, and my cousin were all in the same mental institution. I used to joke that we should get a family raid.
They should have had a punch card.
My brother's schizophrenic, so he has a whole different.
Yeah.
But my mom would like. Wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning, changing the sheets under you in bed.
Yeah.
You know, just very bizarre.
That's a lot of stuff in a little space. Physical,
yeah.
Little
oh, you don't
even space.
Know.
No, I don't even know.
You don't
know.
Even know.
I do not even know.
Snoopy is the only one that knows.
Wow. I'm just looking at the question. We talked about it already about that gremlin. Saying what is the color and size and texture, temperature of this stuff. You know, now we're...
I kind of picture like my mom when I was little and she had kind of the beehive hairdo that went up high.
Yeah.
That's how I kind of picture the voice.
Yeah. I have a weird question for you that is just about me, actually.
Let's see if I know the answer.
Well, here it is. And it's just a question that I'm asking because I'm a guy and you're a woman and like why the hell would I know? But so it's just kind of a reality check. I'm going to DragCon next week, the RuPaul Drag Conference that is here.
He's from Georgia.
Yeah,
where
LA
I'm from.
Conference Center. Last year they did it; it was massively successful. Actors Comedy Studio is going to have a booth there.
Oh, cool!
And I'm going to go and help work the booth and say hello. I've never done any drag before, really. And I'm a straight guy, and so that feels a little weird. And so I've been thinking, like, what kind of woman do I want to be when I show up there? And you know, I think it's easy to do like a draggy, spoofy, but it's kind of a serious, a serious question. And I thought that one of the three outfits that I would bring over the 2 days is, you know, like this Muslim kind of a hijab, which covers your whole body, and then this thing, the niqab, which covers your face except for your eyes. A part of me says, this woman is also still a woman, even though she's totally covered, and she should be there. at DragCon with her sisters.
Yes, but...
Is this weird for you as a woman?
It's not weird for me as a woman, okay. But what makes me wonder if I were Muslim, if I would feel weird having a straight white dude. Well, not straight,
I'm
but
not
just...
white.
What are you?
Oh, a mixture of, you know...
Yeah, but you read white. You know
that,
what I mean?
Not everybody thinks that.
Really?
People ask me if I'm black all the time.
Oh, yeah, you see people are always asking you what your ethnicity is.
But
yeah. I feel, or maybe just a non-Muslim.
I
let me just
away.
Say it that way.
Yeah,
like, okay. I wonder, I just don't know because, you know, it doesn't affect me because I'm not.
You're not Muslim.
I'm not Muslim.
As
but
a
I don't
woman,
know if
no,
it would seem like
issues.
You were making fun of.
Right, okay. Maybe, yeah. But you don't have to answer that part of the question.
Which part?
But just like the Muslim religion part, that's not you. But and the woman... Woman to woman, it doesn't feel disrespectful or...
To women, no.
Yeah, okay. No. I'm checking because why the hell would I know? Right? I mean, I think I just should ask the question. As I've been thinking about it more and more, I don't really have an opinion about these societies and that women dress this way. And, you know, I don't think it's bad or wrong or, I mean, good or, I mean, whatever. But there are also women that... Yeah, should be out there in the community of women. And I also think that as a, you know, straight guy that's going to go dressed as a woman with all this stuff happening, I'm going to get overwhelmed. And there will probably be some parts of every day where I want to be completely covered and have the peace and quiet of no one looking at me.
But you might be the subject of a hate crime.
Well.
You never know. But if you wear this, I mean... More this than that, but you don't get the chance to do like the full drag makeup like you would with this.
Right. Well, I would wear it probably part of the day.
I guess if I were leaning toward, I'd lean toward the one that showed the whole face.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely do that. And I have my face, wear a hijab, and if I, want to cover my face with another scarf, I can I can do that.
I know a lot of women that wear the hijab.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, not a lot, but I know women that wear it, and I've talked to them about it, and it's their choice.
Yeah.
I don't know any women who, you know, I'm probably not allowed to... hang out with women who wear burqas, so I don't know. It's probably not encouraged for them to hang out with me.
No, they, I mean...
I've seen women in burqas.
Out on the street here?
Yeah, I've seen them actually in Atlanta at Six Flags. I used to work at Six Flags.
Oh. Yeah, I may have seen
so hot.
Yeah.
It was like the fucking July in Georgia.
Yeah,
and the humidity. Oh, my God, I felt so sorry for them.
Yeah. But it's protecting, right? They don't wear that in the home, but when they leave the house,
that's where it's hot in the sun.
That's exactly right. What else we have? Laugh Riot Girl Festival.
But look, do you have somebody's going to do your makeup for you and everything?
I'm learning how to do that. I have two different friends. We're going to go shopping. Three different friends. We're going to start going shopping, getting some wigs, makeup, clothing, shoes. All that starts on Monday.
Like, how quickly do you grow facial hair?
I'll need to shave.
Like, did you shave today?
No, I did not.
Oh, okay. Well, then you're probably all right with it.
Yeah, it'll probably.
Some people, like, the minute they shave, they need to shave.
Yeah, my
dad
was,
so the smoother you can get your face, the easier the makeup is going to go.
Right.
It's going to be real weird for you to be getting all this stuff done in your eyeball and all.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know
how
to do
that.
That's
going to be intense.
I mean, that's what I'm going
to do. Well, for me, I prefer putting on my own eyeliner rather than somebody coming at my eyeball with something.
with a sharp little thing
with
a paintbrush.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see. I mean,
think you could pull it off.
Yeah. No, it's going to be fun. But it does feel a little edgy. And then, you know, I get these questions like, it's going to be full of drag queens. I'm going to be drag, but not the queen.
A lot of people who dress in drag are straight.
Yeah. So, but anyway, it brings up all those things. You know what I mean?
You probably get a lot of jokes out of it about what it just feels like to be in a completely different situation, a completely different body.
Yes. Yeah. No. That's the reason to do it. It really is, and that's why I'm asking. You know, I don't want to be disrespectful of women. Uh-huh. That's not the point.
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's a drag show, so the whole purpose of it is
is to have fun and spoof and those kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah.
What kind of shoes are you going to wear?
I don't know. I mean, you know, Gunnar wants me to wear some super high things, but, you know,
I can't pull that off.
Those are hard to walk
in. I have to wear, I wear lesbian shoes. I wear shoes that are not designed to make anyone's dick hard.
Clogs. Yeah.
They're specifically designed.
Clogs and mules.
I wear
Yeah.
Skechers.
Yeah, Clyde
They're designed
Simpsons.
To be comfortable.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, well, let me know how that goes.
All right.
Take a joke notebook with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope we can do a Comedy Death Star broadcast there. Do
oh,
some
cool.
interviews.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we can
fun.
Even shoot some documentary footage of me, you know, picking out clothes and getting getting there.
You could be interviewing people, drag queens, and ask for their advice.
Yeah.
What,
yep.
you know, like how... You know, this is the first time I've ever dressed in drag. What's your advice for me?
Yes.
I'd be like, oh, you got to do this or you got to do that. Or
And I also heard recently that Henry Rollins from Black Flag is going to be at DragCon. And I have no idea why he's going, what his particular interest is in being
Well, he's pretty cool, though.
He's super cool.
I mean, he's not like just this kind of hardcore punk rock asshole that you would think he is. He's, you know.
No, he's
pretty cool. But, tiny guy, though.
Not...
Little person.
Not a tall person.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's cool.
But I'm not sure why he's there. Specifically.
Maybe he's just, you know.
He's going.
Just seemed like a cool thing.
You probably know Rec Overton.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He was here a month ago, and somehow we got on this thing, and he said what he wanted was to nominate Henry Rollins for Supreme Court Justice of the United States.
Oh, wow.
And that so blew my mind, because Henry is smart, he's articulate, he's serious, and he would want to kick ass at that job.
And he's had a lot of experiences.
Yes.
And,
I was like, wow, that would really be good.
Just not Jello Biafra.
No, not Jello. We don't need Jello.
Although he is an activist.
Yeah, but he's
but
also
he's a
like
little wacky.
He's a crabby
misanthrope.
Misanthrope.
I wouldn't mind Rick Overton being on the Supreme Court, actually. He's very smart and political and funny.
He needs the laughs, though. He's a Leo the lion. He needs the laughs.
Yeah,
he's the class clown.
What's his name? Al Franken.
Al Franken.
Yeah. Is a great politician.
Send it to me, Al Franken. I vote. I almost moved to Minnesota just to
vote
for
him
to Congress. Yeah, he's great. All right, we're out of time. We're actually over time. It goes so fast when we're talking about how depressed and weird things are. I would like to thank our very special guest, Bobby Oliver, for coming in today.
Yay.
If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.com. TV. I also said I wanted to start selling rainbow unitards because it sounds like rainbow unicorn and just like a rainbow unitard.
That's what you should wear to drag fest.
A rainbow unitard. Okay. I'm going to be on the lookout. Yeah. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Marmel, good friend of mine. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week. Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.